This episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour, is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based, lottery, and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. For more information, visit GamingLabs.com. Oh, Michael, you know what? Just so you know, I have started recording, and this is going to be included in the episode. We've officially got a sponsor on the podcast.
Who pays money?
Well, I'm not telling you that. Obviously, I'm not fucking sharing it with you. Dude.
I know.
I admire your optimism, but come on.
Yeah, you're not getting paid, Michael. Just John.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Basically.
He needs it.
I figured that.
But
look at him.
Well, luckily,
the audience can't see him.
Luckily, we're not recording video. But I would just like to say, and I just want you to know, this is completely improvised by me, spur of the moment. This episode is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based, lottery, and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. For more information, visit GamingLabs.com. So our new sponsor is GLI.
Oh, it'd be real awkward if somebody else after that introduction.
That would be embarrassing, yeah. Wouldn't it? But I just improvised that because that I'm passionate about. Yeah,
that's really well done.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks. So I'm one of this podcast's hosts. I'm John Bruford. Your other host, my co-pilot. Is Dr. Michael Auer.
This is IP infringement, co-pilot. I'm not an AI. I'm a real person.
Maybe.
I don't think you've ever sounded more like Arnold than I'm not an AI. I'm a real person.
I can't help it. I'm sorry.
Get to the AI.
And I'm really happy nobody asked me to introduce GLI. People would run away scared. What's that? You're going to beat us up.
Well, let's think about this. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based lottery and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world.
Around the world.
Everywhere. I mean, look,
they're gonna find
they're not
you.
Screwing around with the international and GLI. That's they're everywhere.
710 jurisdictions.
Incredible! Wow.
So, listen, just want to say before we get into the meat of all of this, and before we introduce our guest, who you have already heard, folks, make sure you're a consistent distance from your microphone, so it's a pleasant listening experience for everybody out there.
We'll try not to scream.
See, you're too quiet.
Really?
Yeah. Bring your microphone closer.
It's here, man. Look.
Where?
Yeah.
Now just say something with it on the desk.
Yeah, it's here. Next to me.
That's perfect.
Okay.
I will edit that little bit out.
Yeah, right.
Won't
hopefully a lot.
Sound like fools. yes, myself and Dr. Michael Auer. Affectionately known as De Kaiser. And just in case anybody thinks I'm getting political there or perhaps remembering history badly, I'm alluding to not even Michael's countrymen, but of course to the great Franz Beckenbauer, He might have been. He was either the first or the second coach to have won the World Cup both as player and coach, which is a hell of an achievement. And of course, it was German, and Michael is Austrian. But I couldn't think of any comparable Austrians because, you know, who remembers Austrians?
Football players.
Tony Polster.
Tony Polster, well, you know him, really. Come on.
One of the greatest mullets in football history.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I mean, who wouldn't remember him? Yeah, Tony Polster. And obviously, musically, some incredibly famous Austrians.
Mm-hmm. I could pull over my guitar and play some Mozart if you would like.
I do love Mozart, but mostly my love for Mozart is the piano concertos, and I don't think they translate to guitar very well.
Yeah, they do, but it's very hard to play because it wasn't written for the guitar, you know.
Are you saying that you're not able?
I am, in fact. I can play. Yes, I can play it. I can record it, send you a video later on. I mean, not today, but I may do it tomorrow. I can play the classical guitar.
This will be done by AI, I'm sure.
Yeah, I learned it at school, man. I went to the music school. Yes.
What an episode this already is, and we haven't even introduced our guest yet. What a time to be alive. And for anybody that doesn't know, Michael conceived, executed, and composed and arranged our theme tune on this podcast. I'm thinking about adding some lyrics and a bit of vocals over the top. It's just going to be like, get to the chopper!
This is not an AI. This is my friend.
So, in case you're not aware, our guest has been muttering away in the background there. We are joined by, and I'm probably going to get some or all of this wrong, Brett Abarbanel, Executive Director of the International Gaming Institute. This is the more grown-up podcast. On the other podcast, I would have said the next part as professor. But professor.
No, I'm not an ass professor anymore.
You're not?
Associate professor.
I'm a soak professor.
Associate, yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, my ass professor days are behind me as of... four or five years.
Well, that's me. I told you I was going to get it wrong.
Yeah, well, you know. We can't stay in proctology forever, and we have to move on to other things.
An ASOC prof of the Harrah College of Hospitality, all at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Brett, should I call you doctor, professor, or what?
Well, unlike Michael, I'm not currently sitting in a Dach country, so we can just go with Brett and leave all the titles behind.
I'm not sure what Dr. Rao is going to say about
in Las Vegas as Herr Doktor Professor Auer.
So, Dr. Auer, are you comfortable with that?
Well, come again with what?
Dispensing with titles. Can I call you Michael?
Unfortunately, you do all the time.
Yeah, I do. Just when we're not recorded, I like to play to the crowd. So, Brett, thank you for joining us. Very much appreciated. The impetus for getting you on, it came about because we were talking, as in myself and Brett were talking about some of the early recordings we'd done. And the first one was, of course, Leon Zhao, who studied loot boxes and sort of retail gambling mechanisms and mechanisms in gaming as in console gaming and, you know, all that jazz. And I was telling Brett about this, and she piped up and said, "Hey, I know all about that." And so I thought it'd be a nice continuation from episode one to like, whoa, what's going on now? As a nice starting point for us. So Brett, First things first, where does your interest in that area come from?
So I used to not play a lot of video games. I grew up without any sort of gaming console in my house or
electricity,
even, like cable, right? We had basic television channels. We had the first video game I think we technically had in the house. Not the first one I played, because friends had video games. The first one I played was one of the learning games from the Magic School Bus system. Is that a uniquely American thing? Mrs. Frizzle and her dresses and her hair, her frizzy hair. Oh, I'm getting blank looks.
I'm pretty sure that's just you.
This is an American education program then. Maybe North American. I don't know. Might have been in Canada. But that, it was very fun. I learned a lot about the solar system through this mechanism. But for the most part, I was quite the outdoor kid. But I started jumping a lot more into video games and later esports within that too, because I was trying to impress my now husband, which is, of course, what you're not supposed to be admitting to on recorded podcasts. I think you're supposed to say, oh yes, I got into this myself. It wasn't to just chase a love interest.
Chasing tail, I think, is the expression you're looking for, Brent.
Yes, I was chasing tail, and over 20 years later, he's still around. But he's a huge gamer. He loves games. I learned all sorts of different games so that we could play these games together. So we started with Magic the Gathering. We also did things like chess. We played a lot of poker together, though that, of course, I think crosses over all of these worlds. We played World of Warcraft together. We had a lot of fun with that. He was much better than I was, so I didn't always play with him and his friends. But we had a great time. And all of that was, I mean, for the most part, I'll call it standard gameplay. And really, outside of poker and maybe a little bit of Magic the Gathering, which is Wizards Poker, of course, as its infamous nickname, there wasn't a lot that really tied into, kind of as an immediate thing, to the gambling world, which is what I was studying and working in and continue to work in to this day, until there are a few points that really made it crystal clear, this isn't just something you can do for fun on the side. This is something that is relevant to your everyday work. And so I'd say around 2009, but really kicking off around the early 2010s, I started diving into the video games, esports, and gambling overlap. And it turns out this is a space that has only grown from there, and there's always something new to study. And as Leon has discovered as well, there's not just always something to study, but you have an endless list, really, of jurisdictions that will interpret how it exists in very different ways, even up to a few days ago.
Oh, did something happen?
Yes. Oh, what a perfect prompt. You are very practiced at this podcasting thing, aren't you?
I got mad skills. Yes. While it's in my head, when you get home later on, I'd like you to say to your gentleman caller, I'd like you to turn to him, wink, do that little thing with your cheek, yeah, and just say, hey, sugar tits, your name came up at work earlier.
So I'm going to admit that wouldn't be out of place, because I don't even remember what TV show it was, a decade ago, something like that. Somebody called another character Sugar Tits, and we couldn't stop laughing at this. So that actually isn't an out of place nickname in my household from time to time. Doesn't matter. You could, even for visitors sometimes, and even the dog. Yeah. Kaiser has a German name, Die Prinzessin. Because she's a German Shepherd, so.
One of my proudest moments with my mum was, yeah, I was taking her to a hospital appointment, and she kept thanking the sat nav. She wasn't mad; she was just, you know, having a laugh. Yeah. And I said, "Mum, you've got to use the sat nav's name, or it won't know you're talking to her." She said, oh, what's her name? I said, Sugar Tits. And I actually got my mum calling the sat-nav show. Thank you, sugar tits.
How long did this last? Does she still do it to this day?
Oh, no, she's far too dead to do it now. But if you can picture my mum, she bore an almost uncanny resemblance to Dame Judi Dench.
Really? Wow.
So if you can picture...
Were you adopted, or...?
You know, yes. The Germans, or excuse me, I shouldn't say the Germans, the DACH countries as a whole rather famously don't have a very good sense of humor. And I think that Michael very clearly refuses
that. Shows that.
Yeah.
He is 100% illustrating that that is the truth. Yeah. There's nobody listening to this is going to be under any illusions about.
Exactly.
They're just going to be, my God, it's like listening to Schwarzenegger telling a joke.
But, like Michael, the most recent update in the loot box discussion, we'll come specifically into that, is Austrian.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Where the Supreme Court took a different interpretation of loot boxes, specifically in FIFA. So this isn't necessarily a decision that is universal to video games that have chance mechanisms in them. But their approach was to look at loot boxes as part of the greater whole of a video game, rather than is this specific mechanism a gambling mechanism. They said this mechanism is part of the whole of the FIFA game, or rather EA Soccer, I guess at this point, the FIFA game. And as a result, this isn't a big enough part of the game that it warrants classification as game of chance or a gambling game. And therefore, the loot boxes in this case are not gambling, which is very different from the take, for example, in Belgium.
That's a bizarre interpretation. This is only a little bit.
Yeah, it is one of the main arguments that a lot of video game companies have been making, that the idea that you can't look at this thing as a siloed element, it's part of the greater whole of the game, which is, when you think about it from a legal perspective, this is an extremely clever argument. When you look at it as sort of, well, what realistically is this piece of the product, it makes a little bit less sense.
You say it's an extremely clever legal argument, but I'd go back to that and say, okay, we'll review the whole game then.
Well, I mean,
we'll say the whole game has gambling aspects.
I don't want to be a huge ass here, but that's literally what they did. And it was successful. So, I mean, there is some element of cleverness, right, within what
well,
was done.
It has worked.
Not been, however, to your point, so now that I'm done being an ass over here, to your point, that hasn't been a successful argument in other jurisdictions. So, you know, sometimes you win and sometimes you don't.
I just find it really, really peculiar that the proportion of the game that this is even part of the conversation. That's not the point, and that's not the problem.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, the only part of Russian roulette that people disagree with generally after the game is the part where the bullet leaves the end of the barrel. The rest of the game is fine, and that's just a fine, it's a microsecond of the game. The rest of the game's fine. I don't know what people are complaining about.
Well, I think what's also interesting here is they were able to get the court to look at the element of the loot box within the game structure, and not, this wasn't an argument of what role does the loot box play in the game's financial success. Because if we looked at it as part of the revenues that this game drives for its developer, it's not a teeny little piece. It's the vast majority.
No, which kind of makes that argument about what a tiny part of the game it is a little redundant.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's which part? What are you defining here? And that, yeah, I mean, that's part of the complexity of the world we live in, isn't it?
But you've talked to me in the past about the history of loot boxes, mm-hmm. and there was a saturation point in one particular title. Can you explain to us a bit sure. about the history and the evolution of the loot box within a console gaming?
Yeah. Yes, definitely. If I miss whatever clever point you're talking about, please just remind me of what it was.
No, you won't be able to miss it.
Oh, we'll see. So the idea of this loot box, it's not something new, right? Chance elements have been part of games for a very long time, and not just games of chance, but of video games. We've seen these elements of uncertainty show up. The idea of a dice roll that might be in something as basic as Monopoly, or a dice roll that might exist in a digital game. And so that was already present. The idea of putting into a game these loot box concepts, right? The blind box, whatever it was that we wanted to call it at the beginning, originally started as a means of driving revenues after a game was released, mostly for indie games. Because if you are an indie game developer, you don't have the resources that a huge game developer, AAA, is what they would be called, AAA game developer has, to say put, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars into the development of a game and then sell it later. You need to have those hundreds of million dollars to start with to put into the game that would then go and go out to the public. So the concept then we started seeing into the precursor to the concept of games as a service, where you would kind of create a simple game and you would continue developing it after it was released. And the way that you would drive revenues to help you continue developing it after it was released were these loot boxes. The idea that you could spend, you know, just a small amount of money, anything from a couple of cents even at some points to a couple of euros, would then give you some reward in the game. And sometimes that was a specific aesthetic item. Sometimes that was a boost in the game, maybe like a level boost. Sometimes it was a loot box where you didn't know what you would get when you clicked on open on the digital item. And this became incredibly successful. As we know from our field, people like games of chance. This is something that's been part of the human condition for millennia. And as the success of this model grew, turns out, when you have a successful financial model, people will start to emulate this. So it grew and grew, and eventually these huge AAA game developers started building into their products as well. But now what we were starting to see was this phenomenon where a AAA game developer would put a lot of money into the development of a game. Instead of releasing it for free or even for a small amount of money, they would still be selling it for the standard amount, which was usually around... sorry, John, I can't speak to the pounds, dollars conversion, but you usually be equivalent in euros and dollars for the release. And so it was like $60 or so. And then on top of that, they would offer these opportunities to buy more. You could buy more loot boxes. You could buy more items. You could buy more level ups. And suddenly a game that had a flat fee originally would cost a lot more if you really wanted to get everything possible that was in the game, and especially if you wanted to get everything possible in the game immediately. And that sort of urgency is something that we try and tap into often in a lot of everyday pieces of life, not just video games and gambling. And we finally reached, and is this the inflection point perhaps that you were referring to, with a few different areas, but in particular, it was Star Wars, because everything is Star Wars, right? So so we have this huge Star Wars game that comes out, and they've put loot boxes into the game. But what they've done with this case is, one, you have to pay the upfront fee, and then you to get unlock, rather, some of the most desired elements of the game. So, for example, the ability to play as Darth Vader. This is locked behind the loot box firewall or requires an unbelievably massive amount of gameplay time to get it. And somebody did the math on this. It was something like 4,400 hours of gameplay to get Darth Vader. Or if you got real lucky, you could open him on your very first loot box and ha-ha, here you go. You can speak. That's my terrible James Earl Jones impression. You can that's edit that, bad. Right, into a better impression. I didn't even actually, I should curl. That's better. Okay. Put that one in. So, So you could play as James Earl Jones, or rather as Darth Vader. And this just the idea that so much of this core IP of Star Wars was not necessarily even immediately accessible, but so really difficult to get, or you had to get it by random chance, right? Like a lottery draw, which immediately was seen as gambling, right? Loot boxes have already started to develop this reputation as gambling in the gamers' world. Just the backlash was immense. There was a Reddit post that somebody from EA put up about how this was something that all the gamers had clearly indicated they wanted. It's the most, I think still to this day, the most downvoted Reddit post of all time. And there's some competition for that, so that's quite impressive. And the backlash really struck. This was also right around the time that we were starting to see the skins that were coming out of a lot of the Valve corporations, Valve's loot boxes were and still are to this day used as various currencies in on different gambling sites. And so all of these, you know, kind of like a perfect storm for regulators to finally really start paying attention to what was existing in the video games world. Now, I specifically say regulators because there were a few different, right? It's not just gambling regulators that are paying attention. Video games for a very long time have had a lot of artistic license that other, I guess, digital apps, I guess I would say, don't necessarily have. So, for example, in the United States, for a long time, video games were able to do almost whatever they want within sort of the freedom of expression rights that exist, or at least hopefully will remain existing for a long time in our Bill of Rights. I mean, all of these different things that, you know, these are then argued in court, right? We should be able to express ourselves how we want in video games, much in the same way that people are allowed to express how they want to in art, or like visual art, in song, in poetry, right? All of these different things, video games were long considered underneath that umbrella. But now they're starting to include financial transaction mechanisms that are pulling the elements of these games into other different legal and regulatory territories. So that's where we start to get into, here's, I guess, where my role transitions into Leon's world of this entire legal space. Disclaimer here that I'm not a lawyer and I don't want to pretend to be one. But a lot of this then becomes a big interest to a lot of different government entities. And the big, big reason within this is that video games aren't usually age-gated. And so you've got a lot of kids who are playing these games and not realizing that what they're doing might be considered a gambling game, or realizing it and not caring because, you know, when you're, say, 12, you might not care at all. You're just excited to be playing and possibly getting some skins and, ooh, maybe I get some money on the side. And that became a major concern. So the element of problem gambling addiction, which I know you've covered in this area on at least two previous podcasts, so I'm not going to dive too deep here, as well as youth gambling. And then on top of that, general consumer protection elements of, are you being sold a product that's being advertised as something that's not what it is? That becomes a question as well. So between gambling regulators, in some cases, there's also game regulators, right? In France, Argel has purview over quite a bit of video games as well. Financial regulators involved in some capacities. And all these all these different jurisdictions around the world take very different approaches. We talked about the Austrian one. At the beginning of all this now, I guess 9 years ago now, I think it was, Isle of Man did some really interesting work in trying to set up regulation of skins betting websites. So all these different things are unique very much to the area, as well as uniquely dealt with the way with jurisdictions based on how they generally deal with gambling.
There's a lot there.
But... yes, and I tried to be brief. I failed. Sorry about that.
No, you did a great job. I'm thinking like it sort of feels, I mean, the video game industry is pretty old. It's a little bit younger than me, I think. And some of these companies have been around for a long time. I mean, Electronic Arts being a great example. And, you know, they always had the big sports properties. They always had NHLPA and all of that jazz, and great games fundamentally. And I'm going back to, you know, the NES. I'm going back to the Mega Drive and all of that, and, you know, late '80s, early '90s.
Well, think about, John, then. So here's an example, right? I talked about rolling dice and Monopoly. For anybody else who's listening, and like at least two of us, Michael, did you also play Mario Kart?
Sure.
Sure. Excellent. Three of us. The uncertainty when you go through the question mark block, you don't know which prize you're going to get out of that. There is an element of
waiting,
of probability, right? If you're in first versus eighth, you're more likely to get, you know, I don't know.
In eighth, you're more than likely to get the star.
Banana peel versus the magic mushroom, but it's still, you have no guarantee of exactly what you'll get. There is an element of probability and chance involved in that piece too.
Mm. Yeah, if you're middle of the pack in Mario Kart, you have zero clue what you're getting. If you're in first, you ain't getting a red shell.
Yeah. But I mean, what's missing, like back then, I mean, there were those elements like on, even, you know, I had the C64, like, you know, Commodore. I still have it, actually. I mean, I don't know. I didn't reactivate it, but I had it. And you had elements, of course, random elements are, you know, a cornerstone of all of those games. But isn't like the financial reward different? Like now, if you, you know, now you pay basically, because I'd be interested in, when did the micropayments start? So when did they actually realize, okay, we can sell a game, but on top of that, we can also have the consumer buy, you know, features, skins, cars, I don't know what, within the game. So when did that actually start?
That's a good question. I don't know the exact date. I want to say around the early to mid 2000s.
Thing is, like, but there's some genius in this, because I mentioned EA, yep, Electronic Arts, because of the sports properties they have. And stop me if I'm wrong on this, Brett, but if I remember right, the way that the purchases work on what used to be called FIFA is that at the end of the season, you lose it all and you get to start again at the start of the next season.
So, yes, you still do have, though, almost like a Panini sticker book, a collection of what you've had, even if it's not usable again.
Oh, so you can look at pictures of what you've bought.
Well, so you do with Paninis as well, right? That's...
Yeah, but all you're buying with Panini is the image. It's not like, you know, if I say I'm building a Chelsea legend side and I get Zola, at the end of the season, I don't have Zola anymore.
Yeah.
I just have the memory of Zola.
To go back to Michael's question about when this started with digital games, is that even as this was introduced into digital games, it wasn't a new concept, right? We had things like Panini sticker packs. We had things like Magic the Gathering packs, Pokemon cards, all of these things where you open up a pack of cards and you don't know exactly what's going to be in there. You're excited if you get a shiny, right? That's a big thing to get out of a card pack. So the idea of opening one of these packs, that wasn't new, but the digital space completely transformed what it can be. And so as that was introduced, my point is not to contradict what you've asked, Michael, but rather to say that this is, you know, the historical existence of these concepts is something that kind of paralleled popularity of, I'll say, physical or tabletop type games into the digital space as well.
Well, I think Chris Tipping, I think it was episode 4, Michael. Yep. He explained how the Panini brothers thought this up. But it's wild to think that we're still, that simple thing that they thought up to solve a problem, it has become this massive, massive thing. But also, you mentioned skin trading, Brett. And... of course, famously, Roblox, and it has its own currency in Robux. Mm-hmm. And I think the legal challenge that's been put to them has been, I think that's still ongoing, I think.
I believe Roblox is still ongoing. But I mean, as this even shifts, it's like, right, Epic Games famously took loot boxes out of Fortnite and made a big statement about this. This isn't something that we want in our game, but they're back.
What are they?
You know, this was a huge subject for years, and now it's almost like a, you know, sitting over on the side table, and when you want to go visit it, you can. And as the sort of public subject started to come away from public, regular public discourse, we're seeing activity like that. So it may be that we see, kind of like we do with the history of gambling as a whole, this sort of cyclical thing where it's no longer the hot topic, and as it kind of slides away, different companies start bringing it back, and then suddenly we'll see another, usually scandal, that might be what it is, or just backlash, depending on what you do.
When I was saying, like, this sort of seems ungovernable now, I'm partly thinking that is because of the international nature of gaming like this. I mean, it is 100% cross-border. It's not the Wild West, because the governing bodies are the games publishers, and they have an enormous amount of clout.
Yeah.
Because these companies are not what they were in the early 90s. These companies are absolutely gigantic, with enormous recurring revenue, and they can afford the legal protections that come with that. Because let's face it, even a government bringing something against them is not going to be as well funded as Electronic Arts or whoever.
Yeah.
And I do kind of feel like that's, you know, the money that they undoubtedly, and I'm not saying this as a criticism because all industries lobby, but the money that they undoubtedly put into lobbying, there aren't many industries that have access to that kind of money. That kind of recurring revenue, you know, you're really talking about, yeah, maybe gambling companies. But I'm not suggesting for one moment that they should be, just in case any of those lawyers might be listening.
The reality, that the companies control that IP is quite meaningful. There's this superb real-life example of a massive market crash in Counter-Strike skins was only, I'm just looking at the exact date, it must have been in the fall, I'm going to say October, I think that was correct. But what happened was, as Valve has done a few times over the last now 13 years since they opened up skins trading in their games, they made another change. They've done various changes over the years, anything from, you know, changing the probability of getting certain items in loot boxes to doing cease and desist orders to online skins betting sites. But this change was meaningful in terms of affecting the value of what items are. So what they had done was you could take a set number of cheap items and trade them in for a higher level item. But that didn't include certain higher level items. So once you reached a certain tier, those were not achievable by trading in trash. But they changed that. And so now you could trade kind of the lower items for, I think the one that was added in was gold tiers, with the sort of the highest level where you get knives and gloves, which are particularly valuable. Not just because of what they are, but also you physically see them on the screen while you're playing the game. So you can really show off how cool you are. Yeah. But the big thing that this did was it meant that suddenly a ton of really low value items could be traded in for a significantly higher item. And that massively reduced the value of that higher tier item. And the estimate of the skins market, which had at that point been valued at about $6 billion. So just to point out, right, that these video game skins, that purely by the ability, this is such a human being thing, right? It's such a human thing to take something that's tradable, barterable, and convert it into something that can be traded for fiat currency, right? This is just, that's like the history of humankind even. This had become to a point of $6 billion market. And that simple change, you can now trade items in for that higher tier item, wiped out half of the market overnight.
Only half.
I mean, you still have a lot of value in these items. Not everybody can get these sorts of things.
But it's raised the value and the relevance of the smaller items. Yeah. And that's the really interesting part for me.
Raised that value where there's a much larger volume of those items. I mean, this is like, I mean, gosh, days like that, I wish I were a finance researcher instead of a gambling researcher, because the unbelievable ability to kind of fiddle with market dynamics in an environment like this is fascinating. And I'm sure if somebody lost a lot of money, they would hate to hear me say, this is so fascinating, right? And some people did, right? They're keeping this stock. People use this almost like a savings account if you have enough of these items. And that wiped out quite a lot of value in the market. But I think that something else that's interesting here is when you have those sorts of market dynamics prior to this change, you end up in a situation where you get niche wager types, niche, just terminology around what you work on. And since this is the hour with hour, I think that's the subtitle of addiction, right? It's addiction colon hour with hour or something like that. I really should know the names of the podcasts that I speak on. So thank you. You can cut this part out.
You're really overestimating John's skills here.
Oh, okay. In that case, just leave in the fuck up and everyone will know I forgot to double check before we started recording. But this is a really important thing for people who work particularly in the prevention and the treatment world, and that is language. And we talk about this a lot. You know, I talk about how I'm not an addiction specialist, but one of the things that I do a lot of these days is just discuss the different ways that we can communicate across cultural differences. And I don't just mean like, Michael's Austrian and I'm American, so we just, you know, we literally don't speak the same language now, you know, when we are brought up. But this was a terrible example because Michael speaks very good English and I speak terrible German. But the language of communities is very important. So, for example, before I get into specifics here, one of my favorite examples of this is DGEN. I think it is nuts that so many people especially in the harm prevention space, hate the word degen and try not to use it, because there are huge swaths of, especially like professional gambling spaces, sports betting spaces, where degen is just, it's a common term that you might colloquially call one of your friends, and not necessarily to say they have a gambling problem, but maybe they just made a stupid bet. And so that's an example of language. In Counter-Strike, and I totally did this weird circuitous thing to get to my point here, is things like we talk about the really low value of some of these junky items you might get out of loot boxes. The concept of the, quote, inventory clearing bet. This is one of my favorite of all time bets that one might make. You just have a whole bunch of junk in your inventory in your Counter-Strike account. And so you just dump it into one single bet so that you have more space when you're looking at your inventory. You can just look at the shiny, valuable things. And you don't care if you lose because you have a huge volume of low value things. And so you're just trying to dump those things. But stuff like that, like if somebody talked about an inventory clearing bet in one of our, you know, general gambling conversations and you're not familiar with the skins betting scene, it's a foreign concept.
But just to understand, so you place a bet and you could win something, right? So either all of your chunk is gone, or with some chance you win like a better item or better items. That's what it's about, is it?
Yes, correct. Although the way the mechanism typically is set up is it's not so much that you're winning an item, you win a value that then you go to a third party site.
Yeah, okay.
That transfers that value into an item that comes back to your inventory.
But would you say like if you look at the difference between, you know, trading these items and having the chance factor, the loot box, etc., and gambling itself, that in there is some, you know, mediatory item. And in gambling, it's really just about the money, is it? Like, if you gamble, I mean, like classical real money gambling, you play the slots, you play the roulette, there's nothing else other than money in your account, right? Either you have right. it, you win it, you lose it, or you're broke or whatever, but that's the only currency. But there in video gaming, you have something in between, you have items.
Yes and no, because you could argue that casinos hold their own currency, don't they?
In which way?
Chips, plaques, jetons.
Yeah, yeah, I mean physical casinos, right? But not online casinos.
Yeah, well, yeah, but if you look at the sweeps model.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's,
again,
that's
there's an intermediate tier,
yeah, yeah.
isn't
there? That's something in between then, right? Because yeah. the trick about the sweeps model is that it's not about you don't win money, but you
We're
win
certainly
money.
Certainly not suggesting that they're gambling, no.
Equal is.
Yeah, so I agree. Not that these are such disparate points, but I'm with Michael on this one. And I think a good differentiator here is to note that there are market dynamics that affect the value of both the item, right? There's a market dynamics around a skin.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
That aren't just related to the betting. It's almost like its own currency, just as mm-hmm. there's market dynamics that affect the value of fiat currency. So you have not just like the value of whatever cash you're holding, right? When I hold a chip or a plaque from a physical casino, that still has the exact same value as what, you know, say like 100 euros. Whereas if I cash out a skin that has a value of 100 euros, it's possible that tomorrow that skin could be worth 105 euros. It could also be worth 95 euros, right? That has a fluctuating value that a chip or a plaque mm-hmm. wouldn't have.
So it has like, it can develop, right? I mean, you could sort of bet on a certain skin because you believe like a stock that
it's going to go up
in value.
Yeah. I mean, there are people, especially those who started getting into this in 2013, 2014, that view it as an investment market. And so if you've got a really high value item, especially one that is perhaps from 13 or 14 and isn't produced anymore, it's rare, if you will, then you have suddenly something that's worth so much more. And then, of course, that we saw a lot of parallels to this in the rise of things like NFTs. We see parallels to this in crypto. We see parallels to this in all sorts of other areas. Yeah. But those in particular, I think, are quite salient.
But an awful lot of real world value.
Yes.
Is based on scarcity.
$6 billion market, right? That's
right. But scarcity is important in that 6 billion.
Yes.
And you know, gold isn't found everywhere. Yes. Diamonds aren't found everywhere.
Right. And also, John, to your point about the game developer having the control over this, they're dictating the scarcity of these things. So they're almost like in the USB, the Federal Reserve or the central bank that would be, except they have even more control because while the central bank can print more money, it can take some money out of circulation, the game developer has the ability to, for example, completely shut down the economy. If Valve wanted, they could completely remove the ability to trade skins, which would essentially wipe out the value of the entire market.
Yes. Based on the likelihood of things happening.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I don't expect it could happen at a central bank. I hope it wouldn't. We'd probably have kind of like an Armageddon type situation then.
No, but if you think about it in terms of, I kind of feel like we're on the edge of a rabbit hole here. Because you said, you know, that can happen with fiat currency. Of course it can. But crypto is also incredibly volatile and is used in gambling transactions and is likely to become a regulated thing in the not too distant future, you would hope. And it's kind of what one of the things that bothers me about crypto gambling is that enormous volatility. and how that is manipulated. It's harder to manipulate a fiat currency in the short term. But we've seen from that nice man, Mr. Musk, how easily crypto values can be manipulated and how incredibly quickly that happens. And it's kind of when you have individuals or you have not individuals necessarily, but individual organizations with this kind of market power, it does kind of feel like players are being lined up in front of milking machines and they're having these suction cups put on their little game playing udders and they're being quite literally just drained. Because it's with so little oversight and with no unity of oversight, they are pretty much doing whatever they feel like doing.
I mean, one thing, if I may just, you know, coming back a little bit to the psychology, I think, I mean, there are some differences, because so what you describe in terms of, you know, skin betting and you know, and gaming is more similar, I would say, to stock market, because you are betting on the future value of an item, because of course you hope that the items that you purchase or that you trade or that you win are going to be more valuable in the future. And in gambling, it's pretty much happening in the present, right? So if you play a roulette, you know, okay, you bet whatever $10 on a number, and if you're lucky, you are winning a multiple of that number. If you are betting on a color, you know, you are gonna double your bet. So this is happening in a moment. There's no sort of betting on any future development of something, because it's happening right there in that moment. And once the bet is settled, you know, it's gone. So basically, you know, you either won or you lost. In gambling, you don't have this sort of future focusing element, because I often come across like games. So you could have a slot or something that accumulates something, let's put it that way. And what it does, right, and this accumulation could sort of, you know, also change kind of in value. So you could have like a currency in parallel to the money that's going in and that's going out. But I haven't seen that before with gambling companies. You know, this sort of this mix between this future-oriented scarcity item or something like that, and the gambling. Or Brett, have you come across any kind of hybrids between those two worlds?
Yeah. So as you were describing this, the thing I thought of, and I cannot remember his name. There was a guy that made such a great point on this. He was a guest. So I'm going to say this. He was a guest on Dustin Gaukar's podcast, and he was a British guy. So if I figure out his name, I'm really, really sorry that I've forgotten it to plug you here. But he made a point, this sort of a similar concept. And again, also, Michael, very new, right? That's still a very new concept around the, you know, phenomenon of prediction markets or betting exchanges. And having these sorts of things around something like crypto, right? So you could buy Bitcoin as an investment vehicle, right? I bet that it will go up. Or you could go on a prediction market and say that I bet that Bitcoin will go up. So you could either buy the underlying asset expecting it to go up or bet that it will go up. Same thing on the opposite side, right? You can bet that it will go down. You can also say short Bitcoin and expect that it will decrease in price. So then it's not the exact same thing that you've described, but we do see this kind of hybrid of phenomenon of, okay, do you want to do the gambling thing that's related to the asset? Or do you want to bet on the asset itself?
Mm. Yeah, I mean,
I agree. I think it's a unique phenomenon in skins.
Yes. Meanwhile, I've just been thinking of a new strap line for the podcast.
Bring it.
But you have to say this in a very Schwarzenegger kind of tone. Get wiser with the Kaiser.
Give me one of the lyrics for the theme song.
Soon John will start singing, I'm pretty sure. He's probably already practicing every day.
He's got the melody in his head already.
It writes itself.
It writes itself. Get wiser with the guys. That is good. That's like the kind of thing I would expect to see on like a CNBC money show.
Money exactly. Show. That's the kind of quality we're talking.
Or alternatively, a failed YouTube channel.
Yes. Which we only aspire to, as right now we're not doing video. So maybe that's something that we can fail upwards towards in the future.
Well, that's a good point. I forgot briefly we weren't doing a video. So I would like to point out to the listeners that Michael has a fantastic Cheap Trick shirt, and it's fabulous. None of the rest of us have dressed for the occasion today.
I wonder how many know what Cheap Trick is or who Cheap Trick is.
Oh, surely many.
John, might you, you know?
Yeah, of course.
Start, give us a bit of a, you know, a sample of Cheap Trick's most famous songs.
You don't want me to do
that. Start doing Wiser with the Kaiser instead of Surrender.
Surrender. It's in Spider-Man, right? Surrender.
I'm aware of their work.
I want you to want me.
That's probably the biggest song they had in the UK.
I want you.
It's probably
to
the biggest song in the US too.
Yeah, and you know the live version is so it's actually popular, not the album version. The album version is extremely badly recorded, and the live version in Budokan, Japan, Tokyo, from I think 78 or something like this. Is what made them very popular.
You just went full nerd.
No, everybody knows that.
Everybody.
Come on, don't listen to us anymore.
Nerds were just ears up to the speakers saying, he better say Budokan, or he's lost all credibility with me. Doctor of my ass.
But coming back to our actual topic here. So what do you think, like, in terms of, you know, psychology, addiction, etc.? I mean, is there as much research in gaming, loot boxes, etc., compared to gambling? Because I haven't come across a single paper which would have had access to gaming player data similar to what we have, you know, encountered in gambling, where, you know, people like myself or Kasra, your colleague, or you yourself had access to data from actual gambling operators and been able to, you know, look at, you know, player behavior. But nothing like that exists in gaming, does it?
I haven't seen anything like that in gaming. I should put out the disclaimer, right? That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but like you, I haven't seen it. That kind of access is we're still not at that level in the games research field. A lot of what I've seen that looks at this is still very much self-report data.
Yeah.
I don't even think I've seen, for example, I know we've seen access to things like payments data. I don't see that really in the games space. A lot of it is still very much kind of dealing with the mechanics of games and less so with the data of gameplay itself. You can see there's some interesting work that looks at publicly available market data. So there's a lot of trackers that look at, say, a skins market that can track there. But that's mostly like market dynamics research. It's really not about psychology and behavior in individual wagers or individual investments, depending on whatever term the gambler would want to use there. And then I think some of the best examples of that too, actually, are from the, I'd say early 2010s, even late 2000s for World of Warcraft marketplaces. Because one of the interesting things that you could do with those markets is pull data from different servers. So you could see how different players drive different market dynamics in based on sort of which server they're tapping into, and how that might differ, for example, for a role-playing server versus a non-role-playing server, or a server that has a geolocation in Asia versus in Europe, those sorts of things. But for what you're describing, I agree, I have not seen that available.
I mean, there are certainly lots of scales, like psychometric scales, questionnaires that try to tap in. And one more thing, like I think it's also important, it's not an official diagnostic criteria, is it?
Yeah.
Gambling disorder is, but gaming disorder is not.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of, I mean, it might just be anecdotal or even parental, but I think that there are people who are supposedly treating what you've described, you know, it's just there's no formalized structure behind it or a huge amount of studies or whatever, but it'd be very interesting to see how big a slice of the problem loot boxes and their ilk are, because, you know, well, yeah, but it's only a tiny little bit of the game. Yeah. You know, that, you know, feeling really quite mellow and fantastically blissful, it's only a tiny part of taking heroin. And if any lawyers are listening, I'm...
hireable as an expert witness at a very high rate, I assume.
And occasionally satirical, depending on my legal needs at that time. I'm still trying to think of rhymes with De Kaiser and with Hour and... You know,
you're so obsessed, man.
We could do, like, with this, you're going to like this. Mm-hmm. We could do a short version of this, like we used to do with the Gambling Files podcast. We used to do the TLDR version and then the longer RTFM version, which, are you familiar with those acronyms, Michael? TLDR, too long, didn't read. RTFM, read the fucking manual.
Okay.
So that's how we started that one. So we still call the episodes RTFM because we only do the long episodes now. But we could do a shorter, digested version of this podcast and call it A Shower with Hour. So it's just like 10 minutes, just long enough for somebody to listen to while they're having a shower.
A cold shower.
I doubt that it would be a passion killer. So like a cold shower.
So soon you'll start selling me, I think. You know,
there is a technical term for that. It really would be skins trading.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then
should we do a TLDR version? But it's at the end, so you have to listen to the whole thing to get to it.
But that's often how people do TLDRs. Yeah. They do it in a line at the end. You just think, you fucking idiot. Put it at the top. I think you missed the point.
If you haven't done these with other podcasts in the past, people won't think to skip all the way to the end to see if there is one.
So maybe we should just do a post-credit scene.
After 10 minutes.
And it's Michael playing Mozart while you sing the lyrics to the new theme song. Yeah.
I could, you know, record something on my acoustic guitar for another intro, and we could, you know, have to, for future episodes if you want. I'll do it tomorrow. Okay, I just got to practice.
Okay, it'd be great for me to have choices.
Yeah, I'll do it. Mm-hmm.
That's wild. Okay. Doctor, Professor, Executive, Asok, Ababanel, thank you so much for joining us. It felt like we're on the precipice of many rabbit holes there. Even though these things have been around for ages, it still feels to me like it's the Wild West. Mm. And it's the kind of Western where you get into town on your horse and all you want to do is have a little drink. It's first blood, basically. And the games companies are Sheriff Teasel. The gaming companies are Brian Dennehy and his posse. And these poor kids are Sylvester Stallone, who does eventually emerge triumphant, but whilst being led away in handcuffs.
I'll put another video game parallel in. It's like Red Dead Redemption, and then we walk into the saloon out in the middle of nowhere, and there's some slot games available for us to play.
Couldn't possibly comment on that. But it does sound similar.
Yes, quite similar. There's a video game, Red Dead Redemption.
Yep.
Yeah, we know.
To be clear to those who don't spend their times in front of screens constantly.
We're down with the kids.
We're down with the kids, yeah. I don't know if the kids are still playing Red Dead Redemption.
Well, they're playing Red Dead Redemption 2.
Oh, yeah. Okay, fair.
But anyway, Dr. Barmanoff, thank you very, very much for joining us. We might have to have you back.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to come back, as long as Michael wears that shirt again.
I left a better one, different
I just,
one.
You know, I'm going to clarify or a low the shirt. Trick t-shirt, lest that comes across as some terrible sexual harassment statement. That's not what I intended. Oh, boy. Please don't cancel.
Yeah, we've recorded that. But if we do if we have you on an episode and it's a shower with our episode, then who knows what he's going to be wearing? Possibly just some suds and a shower cap.
Excellent. Thank you for making that much worse than my original statement.
It's okay. It's like when somebody complains about pain in their foot and you punch them in the face to distract them. Brett, before we go, I know you've got an event coming up at University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Well, not at the university, it's at the Bellagio, I think, but that's coming up in May. What is it? When is it? And how can people find out about it?
Yes. Thank you, John. Absolutely shameless plug here. We at IGI now host the International Conference on Gambling and Risk-Taking. It has been going on since 1974. We do this only every 3 years, and the next iteration is May 26th to 28th. At the Bellagio here in Las Vegas. The registration is open, the hotel booking is open, and this is an event that is hosted by our academic institute and is for anybody in the gambling world who's interested in learning more about gambling and risk-taking. If you work in the academic space, you come here to see not just what research is out there, but also to learn from the various stakeholders in our field about what's going on and what sort of areas should you be studying to provide relevant work. And if you work in the industry, if you're peripheral to the industry, you work in government, this is the place to come and see what the most timely research of the day is so that you can learn more about what academics and what research can do for the business, for the policy making that you do in your everyday work life. So please come join us May 26th to 28th, 2026 at the Bellagio here in Las Vegas.
What's the web address?
igi.unlv.edu/conference.
Brilliant. Is anybody interesting going to be there?
Yes, Michael Auer will be there presenting his work.
I've heard of him.
Yes, yeah, very interesting guy.
and any fans of the podcast, I'll be there too.
Yes, John will be joining as well as Michael's sidekick.
Yeah, I mean, and it's really the only conference happening in the Americas dedicated to the topic, and it only happens every third year. So everybody interested in that topic, working in that area, should attend.
Sweet. Thank you very much. And we'll see you there.
Hello.